Great, we are in Daniel chapter 6. Now, you need to, it's not going to come up on the screen today. There's going to be some pictures up on the screen that might help some of us connect with the story. So just a little bit of a recap. Remember that Daniel is one of the exiles from Judah, from Jerusalem, from Israel, if you like, the promised land. And because God's people, Israel, have failed to love him, have gone after other gods, after much patience and much warnings, God has finally done what he said he's done, which is to judge them and to bring them into exile. So he sent King Nebuchadnezzar to Jerusalem, and he sacked the city, and he brought loads and loads of captives back to Babylon, thousands of miles away from home, living in a foreign land, living in a place where the one true God isn't worshipped, having to go against the flow. Very, very difficult. That's what we've been seeing. And these faithful servants standing firm for their God in this hostile environment. And that is relevant for us today because we find ourselves in a similar environment. We find ourselves in a world that is hostile to the God of the Bible and hostile to the people who follow him. How are we going to stand firm? How are we going to stay faithful to our God? Well, this is a book that helps us. And here we are at Daniel chapter 6. There's been a regime change, remember? The Babylonians are no longer in power. They've been taken over by the Persians. So chapter 6, verse 1. It pleased Darius, that's the new king. I think we've got a picture of King Darius. There he is on his throne. He's the new guy, new king on the block, we should say. Not new kid on the block, new king on the block. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three chief ministers over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. So there's the satraps and the officials in the background there. Daniel before the king in the red. The satraps were like provincial governors. This was a huge empire covering a vast geographical area, so they were needed. And the three chief ministers were put over the satraps to act, if you like, as anti-corruption officers. Very easy when nearly 3,000 years ago, widespread geography, very, very easy to fleece the king and not give the king what was his due. So in order to keep his eye on these people, he has these three anti-corruption officers, and Daniel is one of them. Verse 3, Daniel so distinguished himself among the chief ministers and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. New king's impressed with Daniel. It's good. Daniel is an old man. So I think that picture there is pretty accurate. So, you know, he's got his gray hair. Probably in his 70s by this time. But he's still serving, he's still working hard, he is excelling as this anti-corruption officer in the king's service. Promotion is on the cards, things are looking good for Daniel. But don't be fooled, the lions are prowling. I think we've got another picture of the men behind Daniel not looking very happy. At this, the chief ministers and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. So teeth are bared, claws are out. These men want to get rid of Daniel. We're not told why. Maybe they're jealous of him because he's getting the promotion. Maybe they were corrupt and they didn't want him rooting out their scams. Maybe they hate the Jews and the God of the Jews, which is probably very likely. So whatever it is, they want to get rid of Daniel. So they dig around for some dirt. And what do they find? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. So they're thinking, how do we bring him down? Nothing on him. Verse 5. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man unless it has something to do with the law of his God." That's striking, isn't it? The one thing they know about Daniel is that he worships and serves his God. What a compliment. They don't mean it as a compliment, of course, but it's a compliment nonetheless. What a great honor to be known in this way, as someone who worships his God. The only thing they can find to trap him is something to do with the love that he has for God. And that got me thinking this week, how are we known by the people around us? What would they say about us if they were describing us? The people that we work with, the people that we live with, the people who are our neighbors. What would they say about us? How are we known? It's quite a challenging thought, isn't it? Anyway, Daniel's enemies, they cook up a plan. Verse 6, the chief ministers and satraps, they went as a group to the king and said, "May King Darius live forever. The royal ministers, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered, in accordance with the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed." So King Darius put the decree in writing. He likes the sound of it, doesn't he? Of course he did. He's a king like that. Wants to be number one. And he fails to see through their scheme. He passes the law. If anyone breaks this law, they're going to become cat food. Big cat food. Whiskers super meat. Here's some interesting facts about lions. Did you know that they're only confined to Africa and parts of India now, lions? But once upon a time, they roamed freely in the Middle East. They roamed freely in Southeast Europe. So you would have found them in Romania, and you would have found them in Ukraine, and that part of the world. Male lions can grow 8 feet long. That's without measuring the tail. So just from backside to tip of the nose, 8 feet. It's massive. A lion's roar can be heard 5 miles away. That's loud. So loud. Isn't it? 5 miles. So, we're here in Kendal. There's a lion in Staveley. And the lion roars. And you can hear it here. Scary, that, isn't it? Come on, flip it out. Lion's claws. Razor sharp. 1.5 inches long. Look at the size of that paw as well. With a paw, a lion can knock a zebra down, no problem. Just poof. Would you want to be put in a den of lions? No way. Well, the trap is set. What will Daniel do? Verse 10, let's find out. When Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. 3 times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. He knows about the decree. He knows about the lions. And he just carries on as normal. A praying man. He's not going to hide away. He's not going to cave in and obey the king and disobey God. That would be to break the first commandment, to have no other gods before the Lord. He would rather be lion meat than disobey the Lord. And so he defies the king, and he prays to the king, the real king. But hang on a minute, doesn't the Bible say that we should obey the authorities? Romans chapter 13, verse 1. Yes, it does. And that's an important thing for us to remember. But the authorities are put there by God, which means that no government has absolute authority. It means all governments rule under the ultimate authority of God himself. So when human governments push us to go against the law of God, God always wins. God wins. He's got to win. And God's people in Daniel know that, don't they? You remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in chapter 3, when the previous king Nebuchadnezzar gave that order to bow down to the statue? They wouldn't bow down. They knew that they must obey God rather than the king. And that's what Daniel does here. And do you know what? We're going to need the same kind of attitude to stand firm for Jesus in the days ahead, I think, in all kinds of different ways. Just reading this week of a law that's been passed in Australia, similar to the law they want to pass here about, you know, the anti-conversion ban thing. The Australian state of Victoria has passed this law, and in the law there's this stipulation that Christians can only pray in a way that affirms that everyone is perfect just as they are. And prayers that talk about a person being broken and needing to repent are deemed to be harmful and illegal. That's Australia. Maybe that's coming here. And if it does come here, what do you do? What will you do? You need to be thinking about that. So, Daniel's enemies, they're watching. Verse 11, these men went as a group, found Daniel praying. There they are, asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human being except to you, your majesty, would be thrown into the lion's den? The king answered, decree stands, in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. Then they said to the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day. So as soon as they catch Daniel praying, they run to the king and they tell tales. We saw Daniel praying, we saw Daniel praying. That's what they're like, isn't it? That's what they're like little kids telling tales. Pathetic. Verse 14, when the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sunset to save him. You can picture him, can't you? There's a picture of him with his stone tablets, but picture him pacing up and down the palace all day, on the phone to his lawyers, on the phone to his fixers. Got to get this sorted. Come on, we've got to find something that get us out of this trap. He realizes he's been had. Daniel is the very best man in his kingdom. He has to save Daniel. He cannot afford to lose Daniel. Verse 15, the men went as a group to King Darius and said, remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. There's nothing he can do. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel. There he is. They brought him to the den, and they threw him into the lion's den. And the king said, Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. He couldn't save Daniel. He's trapped by his own silly law. There's nothing he can do. What a weak king. What a pathetic king. It's just as well that Daniel has put his trust in a different king, another king. So verse 17, a stone is brought and it's placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and the rings of his nobles so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. There's no going back. No one's going to be able to get him out. He's stuck. He sealed him with the lions. And then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. It's a difficult night for Darius. No Netflix, no pizza, no wine, no beer, no sleep. At first light of dawn, verse 19, the king got up. He hurried to the lion's den. And when he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice. Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? Don't you love the next two words? Daniel answered. Daniel answered. May the king live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They've not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty. God's innocent servant is vindicated, shown to be in the right. Well, verse 23, the king was overjoyed, and he gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. Daniel had confidence in the right king, didn't he? Absolutely. Not a mark on him. It's astonishing. Not a scratch. Not a bite. Completely unharmed. Sound familiar? Just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're thrown in that fiery furnace, chapter 3, and they come out completely unsinged. Unburnt. Unsmoked. Absolutely. And now Daniel comes out of the lion's den completely unlioned. Amazing. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den, along with their wives and children. That's Persian justice, by the way. That's not God's justice. In God's law, those who are proved to have been false accusers get the punishment that they have falsely accused someone of, but not their families. This is Persian justice, very, very serious. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Well, there you go. That's important, isn't it? Because that tells us that the lions weren't having an off day when Daniel was thrown in. They hadn't lost their appetite for human meat. They didn't have an upset stomach. It's telling us that Daniel was miraculously rescued. And the writer is also reminding us that it's a deadly thing to oppose the living God. And King Darius, like King Nebuchadnezzar before him, he's made an amazing discovery. It's a discovery that he wants to share. He wants to share with the whole world. So he gets his pen and he writes a decree to go to the whole world. What's he discovered? Verse 25. He writes to all the nations and peoples of every language in all the earth. This is a global message. It's for everybody. May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. That's what he's discovered. And maybe you've noticed, if you've been here with the Daniel series, again and again and again, the book of Daniel presses on us this question. Have you discovered the God of Daniel? Have you made the same discovery that King Nebuchadnezzar did, now that King Darius did? Have you discovered that he is the true and the living God? Have you discovered that? Verse 28, Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And that's the end of our story. A true story. Now, what must we do in the light of Daniel? That's the question, isn't it? In the light of Daniel 6. What does God want us to do? And what God wants us to do is what the people in Daniel 6 needed to do. And if you've got your Bible open, it's there in black and white for us. In verse 26, it's in this decree that Darius sends out to the world. Here's what we need to do. It's verse 26. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. That's the application for us. You must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. So fear means fear. That's a healthy thing, to have a healthy fear. God is big, much bigger than we can ever imagine. It's a good thing to fear God, to have a healthy fear of him. And revere him. So it's to hold him in awe, to hold him with great respect and honor. And also to love him, to adore him, to trust him, to serve him, live for him. That's what it means to fear and reverence the Lord. Why must we do that? Verse 26, verse 27. Here's the answer. Because of who he is. He's the living God. That means he's the real God, the true God. He's living. He's not like false gods who don't exist, who are not living. He's the forever God. Notice that. He lasts forever. His kingdom cannot be overcome, can't be destroyed. His rule will never end. And he's the rescuing God and the saving God. Do you see that? And he's shown that he's the rescuing and saving God by rescuing his servant Daniel from the power of the lions. And that's the lesson to learn about God. And if you've been here these past six weeks now, going through this Daniel series, you might be thinking, haven't we had that lesson already? Yes, we've had that lesson already. We've had it several times already. Why do we need to hear it again? Do we need to hear it again? Yes, we do. We do. Why? Because we leak it. We leak the message. We leak the truth. We forget this truth about God. And we need to have this truth drilled into us again and again and again and again, because we forget it. So, I was thinking this week, the struggles that all of us have, we all have struggles in the Christian life, and we all struggle with pretty much the same things in many, many ways. The struggles that we have in the Christian life are so often a result of not taking in this truth about God properly. So let's think about it. Why is it? Why is it that we give in to temptation so easily and we give ourselves to things that God has forbidden? Why? Well, it's because we've forgotten that God is the living God, who alone can give life, who alone can satisfy. And we've forgotten that he's the forever God, the God whose kingdom endures forever. We've given our hearts to things that don't endure forever. Why is it that we are anxious a lot of the time, or we feel insecure, or we worry? We worry that we've made a wrong decision, or we worry that we might make a wrong decision. And that's a worry that we all know, I think. Well, it's because we've lost sight of the fact that God is the one who controls history. And he controls our lives. And his kingdom cannot be shaken. So when we're in him, we're secure, aren't we, in his power? And we forgot that. And so we're anxious and we worry. Why is it that we're so often silent when we get an opportunity to speak up for Jesus? Why is it that we try and fit in and go with the flow and not stand out for Jesus? Why is that? Well, it's because we've lost sight of the truth that he's the living God, that he's the only one who can save people. He's the only one who can save them. There's no other hope for them. And we've lost sight of the fact that he's the one to be feared and not them. He's all-powerful. He's indestructible. And so instead of fearing him, we feared human beings whose power is limited and whose rule and influence over us will not last. It will vanish. We've lost sight of the indestructible God. Why do we struggle to give our money to God's work? We've forgotten that his kingdom lasts forever, and we've invested our material wealth in things that don't last forever. Why do we fear death? It's because we don't really trust that he's the living God who endures forever. The one who rescues and saves people from the power of our enemies, even our greatest enemy, death. And why is it that we fail to pray? It's because we've forgotten that he's the all-powerful ruler. He's the ruler of the world, the whole world, and he is able to keep his promise to rescue and to save. He's able to do immeasurably more than we can ever ask or imagine. When we forget this, we get into all sorts of struggles and difficulties. And we all do. Every single one of us. And that's why we all need this Daniel chapter 6, verse 26 and verse 27 reminder of who God is, so that we fear him above everybody else, and we revere him above everybody else, and we entrust our lives into his safekeeping. Now, someone might say, hang on a minute. All of this was such a long time ago. This is something that happened 2,600 years ago. It happened to somebody else, Daniel. Is this really a sound basis for me, for you, for us, to entrust our lives into God's hands in this way? Is it a sound basis? Yes, it is. Absolutely. If this is all we had, it is still a very sound basis for us to do exactly what Darius and Nebuchadnezzar before him did, and that's entrust ourselves to this God. If the Bible ended there, we still have every reason to trust him. But the Bible doesn't end there, does it? We don't just have what happened to Daniel. We've got more to go on than Darius when it comes to reasons for entrusting our lives into the hands of this God. Much more reason to trust him than they did. And that's because living where we live in New Testament times, we know of another godly man who completely trusted God. Another godly man who continually served God and who was willing to face death for God. A man who was a man of prayer. A man who refused to do the ungodly thing. A man who only ever did what was right. A man who, even though he did what was right, always was hated by the leaders of his day. An innocent man whose enemies could find no fault in him. A man who was brought before a weak ruler who wanted to save him, didn't want to put him to death, but whose attempts to save him failed. We know of a man who was condemned to die, a man who did die, and died on a cross, a man whose dead body was put in a tomb, a cave, and a stone was placed over that entrance to that cave, and then it was sealed by the authorities of the day. Here's a man whose friends hurried to the tomb early one morning, and they made the most amazing discovery in all history. Jesus is alive. He's alive. He's alive. Raised to life by God. Innocent servant, vindicated, shown to be in the right. So Daniel 6 should have sounded familiar to us as we were reading through it. If you think that Jesus' resemblance to Daniel is uncanny, or that Daniel's resemblance to Jesus is uncanny, you're supposed to think that. It is extraordinary. It is striking. All through the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, written centuries before Jesus, there is this picture building of a great person to come. You can see an outline, you can see a shape, a shadow, and that's what the Bible calls these pictures in the Old Testament. They're shadows. Over time, become clearer and clearer and clearer. God is telling us in all these things what to expect when the true king comes. What to expect when the true servant arrives. What to expect when the true savior comes. So that when he does come, when he does arrive, we know who he is. And we put our trust in him. And the true servant of God, the true king of the world, the true savior of the world has arrived. And it's Jesus. Beyond any reasonable doubt, it's Jesus. He is the king that God has sent. And we should trust him. With the coming of Jesus, God has shown us so, so clearly that he is the living God who rules forever. He has shown us so clearly that he is the God who rescues and saves. In his death and in the death and resurrection of Jesus, God has performed the greatest sign and the greatest wonder ever. He has raised his servant, Jesus, from the power of death. He is 100% trustworthy, isn't he? He is a God you really can trust. You can throw your life upon him, knowing that it's safe. Entirely trustworthy. We have got so much more to go on than Darius. So what do we do? What's the wise thing to do? It's to fear him. Fear the Lord. Revere the Lord. Trust the Lord. You know it makes sense. And if you choose to do that, entrust your life to the real king, you follow the real king, there's something that you need to know as we finish. Something you really need to know. And it's this, that the world is hostile to Jesus' people. Just as it was hostile to Jesus, just as it was hostile to Daniel before him. And you follow Jesus, well, for a while, if you've been following him for a while, you probably have discovered this. If you follow Jesus, people will oppose you. People won't like the fact that you follow Jesus. People will try and make life difficult for you. They'll try and make you give up following Jesus. When that happens, and it will happen, when that happens, remember who is behind the hostility. This is what the Bible tells us. 1 Peter 1, verses 5, chapter 5, verse 8. Remember, your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. It's like we're living in a lion's den, a dangerous place. Remember who's behind the hostility, and then remember this. Remember Jesus, the servant king. Remember that Jesus defeated that lion on the cross, once and for all. And keep trusting him, because Jesus is the living God who endures forever. His kingdom will never end. He is the God who rescues. He is the God who saves. He is the God who has rescued you. If you're trusting in him, he has rescued you from the power of sin, from the power of Satan, from the power of death, from the power of hell. He's rescued you forever. Trust him. He's worthy of our trust. 1920s Soviet Union, so just about 100 years ago, it was illegal to preach the gospel of Jesus in the Soviet Union. Baptist preacher Cornelius Martins refused to obey that law. Had to, because we've got to preach the gospel. And he was brought before the communist authorities. The communist boss ordered two of his thugs who were in the room to strip Cornelius Martins. Strip him naked, to humiliate him. Martin says, "You don't need to do that, I'll undress myself." So, took off his clothes. He's standing there. And then he said to them, "I don't fear to die. If you kill me, I'm going home to the Lord. And if he has decided that my hour has not yet come, then you can't do any harm to me here." He believed, didn't he? Believed Daniel 6, 26, 27. He believed in the great big God who rules and who rescues and saves. Well, the official, you can imagine, absolutely enraged at this. And he picked up his revolver and he aimed it at Cornelius Martin's head. 3 times he tried to shoot him, but his finger froze on the trigger and his body is shaking as if he was having a heart attack. And he couldn't kill him. And in the end, he just says, "Go away and never come back here again." And off he went and continued to preach the good news of the one true God, who is worthy of our trust, because he is the God who saves and rescues. Don't give up trusting God. Don't be afraid of those who kill the body and after that can't do no more. Fear him, Jesus says, who, after killing the body, has the power to throw you into hell. That's a healthy fear to have. And this is what we need to have as we face the future, remembering that we have this God who is big, who is strong, who is great, and most importantly of all, who loves us.